United States v. Ellis. Mr. O'Daniel.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor, and good morning. First of all, this is jurisdiction of this case is under 28 U.S.C. 1291 and 18 U.S.C. 3742B. There's a jury verdict, all three counts. He received 300 months concurrent after being found by the court to be an armed career offender. There are three issues that I briefed. Briefly want to touch on the first one. That's a severance issue. I understand that's an abuse of discretion standard. I won't add anything to that. I believe the judge was wrong in not severing count three from count one and two. They were different times, different dates. Moving on, though, the third issue dealt with the armed career offender aspect and whether or not Apprendi applied in Booker and Blakely and whether or not he's entitled to a jury trial on those issues. The court has addressed this in a couple issues recently, the Pittman case as well as the Shepard case. In each case, they have essentially found that these are factual determinations made by the judge. However, the court also, in the Pittman case, the only issue was whether or not he was 18 years of age or more or at the time of the offenses. They said that's really not an issue that needs to be remanded for the court. However, the Shepard case is really very close on point with the Ellis case in that they had to go back and look at the whether a burglary conviction was a general burglary conviction or something lesser, because that is the determination of whether or not it's a crime of violence or not to trigger the Armed Career Offender Act. In this case, documents were submitted by the U.S. attorney to the court at a sentencing hearing whereby a burglary conviction was shown. However, on examination of a witness, there was no factual basis by which they could glean any of the facts. They only saw that the burglary, there was a burglary charge. It was an aggravated burglary charge. He did plead guilty. However, he only received 85 days incarceration and 30 months of probation. That doesn't trigger my thought of it as being a violent crime, considering some of his previous record, which may be before the court. We would ask that, first of all, we believe that the jury trial should be triggered there because he was subjected to a term of incarceration greater than the maximum of 10 years on counts 1 through 3.
Well, it's not a jury. I mean, the most you would get, if you got anything, was the opportunity for sentencing by the court with the advisory range determined by the court. I mean, we're not in that nether world we lived in between Blakely and Booker, where we thought we had to have jury trials and all these things.
And I'm sorry for interrupting.
No, it's okay. I would love for you to get onto your hearsay point because
sure.
That it seems to me is the central issue.
I do believe that is the central issue here, and in essence, what we have here is a Crawford issue. In this case, blood and urine evidence was gathered as a result of Indiana's implied consent law, which, under suspicion of drunk driving, one is required to submit to a chemical analysis or chemical test or face risk losing his license for a period of 1 year. Those tests are gathered explicitly for the use of criminal prosecution or not. It is, and this court most recently heard a case called in Gilbertson, and one of the justices wrote the opinion, and it was issued just a couple weeks ago. And I think that opinion is very perceptive in the analysis one goes through.
Thank you.
With regard to that particular case, that was an odometer statement case. Those odometer statements are required to be given upon the sale of a vehicle to the Bureau of Motor Vehicles, though that is that's a business record.
Well, and I just wanted to kind of get to the heart of that here, because odometers, of course, are used for all sorts of things. But the fact is, even though the purpose of this particular blood test happened to have something to do with law enforcement blood and urine tests, I guess.
Sure.
Hospitals do blood and urine tests all day, every day, all the time. It's their business of, you know, one of the things they do. And so it seems to me not a big stretch to say that the records themselves, and I want to distinguish the affidavit under 902.11, which might have a different problem, but I don't see why the hospital's records themselves properly authenticated or non-testimonial. This is there's no reason the hospital would do an odd blood test just because the police happen to have asked for this one.
Well, in essence, what we have here, and I think we can go back to the Garnett case, which the government had cited as well, is talking about forensic lab evidence and how that might be able to come in under some business records exception. Now, that's pre-Crawford. However, it does say in that case that it does require the testimony of a custodian or other qualified witness who can explain the record-keeping process.
Well,
that was not done in this case.
Right. That's why I wanted to separate. It seems to me, you know, we got all these layers all the time of, you know, potential hearsay. And the piece of paper that says, here's the result, you know, from the blood test, you know, all this, you know, he's got methamphetamine in his system. That itself, it seems to me, is non-testimonial. Maybe hearsay in some sense, an out-of-court statement. But it strikes me, since it's in the hospital's ordinary business to analyze people's blood. Now, though, you have the record keeper who comes in by affidavit here, right, under the 902.11 procedure, and is never called.
At least some medical custodian, whether I'm not sure if it was actually the record. Perhaps it's the medical record
keeper. Actually, I think in this instance it was the woman who did the test.
I don't believe it was Brandy. I don't believe we had a
certification pursuant to. Yeah, it is.
Okay.
It's Brandy Harding.
The
paper says Rule 8036 and 902.11.
Sure.
So she comes in. She has executed under penalty of perjury this affidavit. And it seems to me your issue is to explain to us why Crawford, in effect, requires us to change Rule 902.11 or somehow to handle that rule differently.
Well, I think that the difference there is we did not have the opportunity to cross-examine her. Just because she submits information, there are various
qualities. Did you try to call her?
We didn't know her name. We didn't know her name.
But
in fact, the officer didn't.
This says Government Exhibit.
It was. However, that
government
was not
Exhibit 6.
That was not presented to me until the day before trial, I believe.
Well, you know her name at that point because it's on the exhibit.
Perhaps. I can't recall from that time whether we attempted to contact her or not. I know we asked the officer what her name was. He did not know. He just knew her as Brandy.
There's no allegation that the police requested the blood test be given, is there?
Oh, absolutely there is. This was pursuant to a suspicion of operating while intoxicated. They took standard field sobriety test and
received nothing.
They then took him to the hospital, and one of the officers observed the urine sample, however not the blood. We don't know what procedures are normally done in the course of business to determine how they spent out the blood, to determine whether or not there was methamphetamine. We don't know whether there's any sort of checks and balances within the hospital to determine whether those instruments are certified or what the accuracy of them are. And so, and because it goes centrally to count two, that being possession of a firearm by someone who is a habitual user of a controlled substance, I think it makes it very central to the case, and certainly we should be able to cross-examine this individual. She was not declared unavailable by the judge or anyone, and it did come in under the judge specified it was under the certified business record. I think my brief indicates medical record. However, I think the same analysis applies.
Well, here's one thought anyway. 902.11 puts the obligation on the party intending to offer the record into evidence, here the government, to provide written notice of that intention to all adverse parties, make the record and declaration available for inspection sufficiently in advance of the offering into evidence to provide an adverse party with a fair opportunity to challenge them. That's what the rule says. And so, I mean, I don't understand you to be arguing that you didn't get this in enough time, but it looks like the rule is trying to give you that opportunity to cross-examine or some, you know, maybe call the witness, find out if she's available, whatever, to follow through. And because I'm trying, again, my ultimate question is, does Crawford require us somehow to treat Rule 90211 differently from the way we've been treating it? The rule itself isn't all that old, but that doesn't matter. Neither is Crawford.
And I think that, and I see that my time's running out short, but I'll just continue on this line. I think the distinction here is not whether or not 90211 applies, but whether or not the right to confrontation, the Sixth Amendment, is triggered, and whether or not somebody is...
Right, and I think I'm saying the same thing. Does the right to confrontation that you're arguing for exist in Crawford trump the rule in that sense
and I
require
believe it does.
That person to be called?
And I believe it does. I think that's exactly what Crawford's trying to get at, is saying, look, if you've got somebody who can... And let me just finish my thought. If you've got somebody who's available, and clearly this person is available for examination, then the defendant should have an opportunity to cross-examine that person as to the methods and manners in which they obtained that evidence. And clearly, Crawford is implicated here because it is strictly and solely used by the government in the prosecution of a case. And that's exactly what Crawford and Justice Thomas talked about in Crawford as one of the main pitfalls to avoid here.
You're factually distinguished from Gilbertson in several ways, are you not, then?
Yes. I think Gilbertson is clearly a ministerial thing that auto dealers or whomever have to submit that as a declaration to the Bureau of Motor Vehicles. However, here there's no requirement for the hospital to take this. This isn't in the course of medical treatment. This is specifically
that was my question. I asked the police requested the blood test.
Yes. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. O'Daniel. Mr. Schellenbarger.
May it please the court, my name is Todd Schellenberger. I'm an assistant United States attorney in the Southern District of Indiana, and I represent the United States in this appeal. The United States is asking the court to affirm the convictions and sentence imposed in Mr. Ellis's case for three reasons. First, the district court did not abuse its discretion by denying Mr. Ellis's motion to sever count three. The district court decision on that point is supported by two opinions of this court that address Rule 8A, the joinder, Criminal Rule 8A, the joinder rule in the context of firearms prosecutions. Secondly, the 803 business records admitted in Mr. Ellis's trial fall within the scope of the Supreme Court's definition of testimonial hearsay based on the examples that the Supreme Court provided within the opinion.
I think you mean non-testimonial.
They fall outside the scope of testimonial hearsay, Your Honor.
But why is it not important to call in this instance the custodian at, you know, Ms. Harding, who, you know, says in this thing that she's the custodian of the records of the business named below or otherwise qualified? She seems to be the person who assisted with these tests. But I can see all sorts of value in the ability to cross-examine her about these very damning underlying medical records, which, as Judge Kaney's been pointing out, don't look much like the odometer records. These are asked for by law enforcement personnel, done for law enforcement purposes.
Your Honor, to address one point the defense counsel and Mr. Ellis's counsel raised about notice, there was notice provided to counsel on May 11th, and the trial was on June 1st in the form of a pleading notice notifying counsel that these records would be offered through
90211. So you're saying you gave your
90211. He had pretrial notice. There was no pretrial objection related to Crawford.
When were they delivered, though?
The pleading, which was filed with the court on May 11th, indicates that they have been provided to defense counsel. So certainly on or before that date, Your Honor.
All right.
Which was several, at least two or more weeks
because,
before the trial.
Because the rule does require that. You have to have both the record, that is to say the business record you're going to admit, and the declaration made available. Yeah.
Yes, Your Honor. The question about what, with regard to whether or not these are testimonial, I think must look at the examples within the Crawford opinion. There, specifically, the Crawford case involved police interrogation of a witness and the use of that interrogation in a subsequent trial when the witness was unavailable for cross-examination. These records are not testimonial in nature, and they were not prepared by a law enforcement organization. It is true they were prepared at the request. The tests were performed at the request, but not performed by a law enforcement organization. And a hospital performs these type of tests regularly. I think their records have an independent indicia of reliability because of the fact that they are separate and apart from the law enforcement agency.
Well, we said in Gilbertson, though, that the idea that the police initiated with an idea of prosecution, and that was the case here, though.
That is true, Your Honor. But I think there's some distinctions that can be made with regard to what entity controlled the production of the record, the data in the record, and that is not the law enforcement agency in this case. That's an independent organization, the hospital, which I think has strong indicia of reliability as regular business records do, and that is the justification for the hearsay exception for such records. It is true that the exact definition of testimonial hearsay has not yet been completely formulated, and if this court determines that the 803 records that were admitted in Mr. Ellis's trial do fall within the definition of testimonial hearsay, there is substantial evidence within this record that would allow the court to find that an error by the district court in admitting the records was harmless, given the substantial amount of additional evidence.
There was some additional evidence, but it's hard for me to imagine that this powerful evidence of the methamphetamine in his system wouldn't have just been the open and shut fact of, you know, is he a user? Well, there it is in his system. And so, yes, there are these other things, but nobody ever analyzes the flakes on the spoon, do they?
They were not analyzed, Your Honor.
Right. So, and then you've got this other guy kind of with his testimony. If it had all properly been before the jury, you know, could a jury have found, based only on that he was a user? Maybe. But I have trouble thinking that this blood evidence, you know, the medical tests weren't so strong as to overwhelm anything else.
I know the court's familiar with the testimony of the individual. He said that he lived with Mr. Ellis at this time, that he saw him use methamphetamine, that he was an IV methamphetamine user.
But did he need to say he's used methamphetamine at some point in his life, or did he need to say he used methamphetamine on the occasion when he was arrested? How long ago? I mean, is it enough if he used it 5 years ago?
Well, that's not what his testimony was. It was during the year of 2004, before July, and on cross-examination, he said he lived with him at the time of this offense, and he testified that he talked with him about the vehicle stop that was involved in this offense. And so there was strong indication that he knew him at the times that we're talking about in this offense, taking his testimony both direct and cross-examination as a whole. In particular, he said he was an IV. He preferred to use methamphetamine by IV, by injecting him with syringes. The officer that made the stop recovered a number of syringes that were admitted, at least a photograph of those were admitted during the trial. The officer explained, giving his lay witness opinion or expert opinion about how individuals use methamphetamine, and described the use of spoons and cotton to make a solution and draw it into a syringe and then shoot it, and that there is a crystalline residue left as a result of that process. One of the spoons admitted and submitted to the jury had a crystal, white crystal residue on it that was visible to the jury. And the witness also indicated that Mr. Ellis preferred to carry his paraphernalia in camouflage zip bags. And that is exactly a bag just of that description was found in the vehicle with the syringes and the spoons, and the one of the spoons had the residue on it. So there was quite a bit of evidence apart from this test result supporting a conclusion by the jury that Mr. Ellis was a methamphetamine user or controlled substance, unlawful controlled substance user at the time of the offense. the evidence, the testimony by that witness regarding the fact that Mr. Ellis was a methamphetamine user was uncontroverted in cross-examination during the trial. Lastly, the court should affirm Mr. Ellis' sentence in this case because, contrary to Mr. Ellis' contentions, the Almendarez-Torres case has not been overruled, and the Booker Supreme Court opinion does not prohibit district court judges from making guideline offense level determinations or criminal history determinations. The Booker Supreme Court opinion itself had to do with matters other than criminal record.
I thought Mr. O'Daniels make a slightly different argument, though. In some of our post-Shepherd cases, we've said this particular offense is ambiguous enough. We're not sure if it fits or not, you know, if you're actually making an ascertainment about course of conduct. So it's not an Almendarez-Torres argument he's making at the moment. It seems to be a Shepherd argument.
Mr. Ellis did not challenge whether or not any of these offenses met the definition of a crime of violence at trial, Your Honor. I don't believe that that argument is appropriate before the court at this time.
Okay.
The admissibility of the medical records really only goes to count two, then. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. I see my time is almost up. If the court has any further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Sallenbacher. Mr. O'Daniel, you may have a minute.
Thank you.
Mr. Schellenberger talks about harmless error, and I think Justice was correct in saying that the testimony, or actually the medical evidence, was overpowering as to any other witnesses. Clearly, once that's admissible, there's not a whole lot I can do at that point. And cross-examining Justin Gourley concerning what he may have seen at some time prior to July, I don't know that that would rise to the level of whether or not he was a habitual user of a controlled substance at the time on March 25th, 2004, when he was stopped. In addition, the bag, he did not say that he carried it in camouflage Ziploc bags. He said he liked camouflage and he would carry it in Zip bags. He had seen him use IV through IV, but however, there was also another person in the vehicle, too. And I think that's something that may be a distinction before the court. I think even though it may go to count two only, I think that does taint the entire trial. And so we would ask that a new trial be granted.
All right. Our thanks to both counsel. Mr. O'Daniel, an additional thanks to you for accepting this appointment and ably representing the appellant.